Before we begin with our first argument this morning, I have a couple of small announcements to make. Number one, I think that you will notice that we now have a full complement of justices on the bench, with Justice Rebecca Bradley joining us as our seventh member. Also, I want to let you know that the court is going to try very hard to adhere to the time limits. We give each side of an argument 30 minutes apiece, and the lawyers are always very good about minding the lights. And for those of you that don't know how the lights work, green light means the lawyer can begin talking. Yellow light tells the lawyer you have 5 minutes, you should be thinking about winding up. And the red light means to stop. And the lawyers are very good about it. Unfortunately, we are not always very good about it, and there have been times when one side has received much more time than the other to argue the case that is being presented. So we're going to try very hard to stick to the time limits because we want it to be fair to both sides. We want it also to appear to be fair to both sides. And we have Wisconsin Eye that has us recorded as we go, and those people that are out there watching, we want them to know that we are trying to adhere to the timeline. So if you see me urging my colleagues along a little bit, that would be the reason why that is occurring. So I'll now call our first case, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Boyle, 14 AP 482. Counsel, are you ready to proceed? Please do.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Gerald Boyle. I'm an attorney from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I certainly want to express my condolences for the loss of the great Justice Crooks and kudos to Justice Bradley on her appointment. I'm here to discuss, I must say, Madam Chief Justice, there was some, the older you get, the harder hearing you are. There are some things that you said that I did not hear. So if I am going off anything you had told us about we should be doing, please take it granted. I tried to hear, but I didn't.
Yeah, well, this room is not the greatest for its acoustics either. We are having our speakers fixed in December, but we couldn't get it done over the summer. So it's not all because of your ears, Counselor. We have a little bit of problems hearing up here, too, on the bench. But please proceed.
Thank you, ma'am. The adage that any lawyer represents himself as a fool for a client is still quite a good adage and quite true, besides the fee being perfect for me in this case. I also know it from the back of my hand for having spent so much time on it. I also have an adage that I learned as a young officer in the Army that no matter what happens, you never make an excuse. Even if you don't even know what they're talking about, the answer is no excuse, sir. On this case, I have to say no excuse to the court for some of the mistakes that I made and not having certain things taken care of that should have been taken care of. And even if it were done by somebody other than me, I will take responsibility because that's what I'm supposed to do. Now, what's this case all about? This case started when I was contacted by a man by the name of David Peterson on a very, very involved problem of him having been, in my opinion and in his opinion, a victim of a fraud. And the fraud had to do with memorabilia of people selling items involving doodles that Mr. John Lennon made that really were probably not made by him. And the way that all started was a man by the name of Eric Spikin, who is one of the five people in the nation, or maybe even in the world, that is an expert in what's called inking, where he can determine by doing a chemical process as to whether or not the writing that was seen on the item was made by a instrument, to wit a pen, that was or was not in existence at the time the author penned his name to that writing. There were three entities that had to be looked at, one in New York, one in Florida, and one in Hawaii. The only one of those three cases that was, in my opinion, a winner was the one in Hawaii, because besides the fact that Mr. Spikine would appear and say this writing done by Mr. Lennon was done by a pen that was not in existence at the time Mr. Lennon was alive, we had a false provenance. The false provenance was that the gentleman in Hawaii, in the provenance that he authored, said that he had received the John Lennon memorabilia from the son of a Dr. Seinfeld, who had been the Surgeon General under a president. And upon Mr. Peterson, who did a yeoman's job of getting information for me, found that Mr. Seinfeld had no sons. Totally false. He had talked to his daughter. I believe I talked to his daughter or had some communication with her. She was an assistant or deputy district attorney in Los Angeles, said there were no boys in that family. I also learned of a woman by the name of Emmy Moshida, name I believe is Toshida, and she was sued by me, and then I talked to her and I dropped her from the lawsuit with clear-cut understanding that she was going to be a witness for me, that she was going to tell me that fraud was wholesale in that gallery in Hawaii, and that she would assist me in testifying as to that. That case was made. The other two were not. I had nothing but the act of a sale. I had nothing to show that there was sufficient nexus between the seller and the state of Wisconsin that would allow me to get over a serious challenge as to whether or not the DPA Act even had anything to do with this case. Besides that, it would have been two more lawsuits, and it would have become unmanageable. But I would have filed the lawsuits if I thought I had sufficient proof. I did not. Now, I think a lawyer who has been in the business as long as I have been would know when or when not to bring a lawsuit.
Not going to
bring a lawsuit.
Did you advise your client?
I'm sorry, Madam Chief Justice. Madam Avery.
Did you advise your client that you didn't have any proof and therefore could not bring a lawsuit? One of the issues here is whether you kept your client informed.
I heard everything but the last part of what you said.
I said that one of the issues here is whether you kept your client informed.
Oh, Justice Abrahamson, I never have ever had a client I talked to more than Mr. Peterson. I have never had a client.
I have another.
Beg your pardon, ma'am?
I said, I don't know what the rule is that the court adopted, so I shouldn't really hold you to it, but the court has adopted the principle of keeping victims' names out of appeals where the matter is on the internet. Now, oral argument here is not on the internet, but it is recorded and it's archived for a long time. So I would appreciate your not using the victims, the alleged victims' names here. Use their initials, please.
Well, I'm so embarrassed that I can't say that I clearly understand your question, and I'm very, very sorry about that.
Don't use DP's name. Just use the initials.
I just wish to tell the court that there were two other places from which Mr. Peterson bought the memorabilia. I contacted both of those gentlemen. I talked to one in Florida at length. His name was Jerry Gladstone. He indicated to me that he had no idea that there was any fraud in the items that he sold and that he would make appropriate compensation. The problem with that was, by that time, we had arrived at a program, Mr. Peterson and I, that we would go through the case with the fellow from Hawaii, get him under oath, and see if we could find any evidence of any conspiracy between Hawaii, New York, and Florida. That was the plan that we agreed upon, and that's the plan that I proceeded on. I did not feel, and having talked to my expert, that I could possibly have sued Mr. Gladstone or the gentleman, Mr. Kaczynski from New York, and been successful, and whether or not he, Mr. Spikin, could really be an expert witness for me. Once I learned that from Mr. Spikin, who I developed a very close relationship with, who I met in Michigan, who I met in Florida, and who I met in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee one was with Mr. Peterson present, that the only case that we were going to proceed on was the case that I've already outlined to the court. It was our hope that we would be able to have a fraud case, not a DPA case, but a fraud case against the gentleman from New York and the gentleman from Florida if, during the process of discovery, we were able to find sufficient facts that would assist us in that regard.
Mr. Boyle, is your appearance and your brief designed to object to the referee's findings of violation of code, or is your prime function or argument that the discipline is too harsh, as proposed? Pardon me?
Mr. Boyle, let me, if I may, interject. I wonder if the marshal has some apparatus that might be of assistance.
Are you kind? Thank you so much.
Let's get that all situated, and then we can continue.
Thank you, Justice. Now I think I can hear you, Your Honor.
Good. And we've used that before, and I apologize for not remembering, and thank Justice Bradley for doing that.
Thank you.
Okay. Simply put, I want to know what your basic argument here is today. Is it that you did not violate any code provision in any of the two clients that are involved here? Or is it that 60-day suspension is too much?
Well, it certainly is the former. The former. I did absolutely nothing wrong in my relationship with Mr. Peterson vis-a-vis the case that might have been viable out of New York and might have been viable out of Florida.
Well, did you have a written agreement with him about what your payments would be, what your fee was going to be?
No, ma'am, I did not. I had an oral agreement with him. I did not comply with the SCR.
That's a violation.
Yes, of course.
Okay. That's what I'm trying to get at.
Yes, ma'am. I'm not in any way suggesting that it isn't. All I can say, however, is that every dollar I received has been more than earned, and I think there's a recognition of that because there's been no such claim that I took money and I didn't do the services. But I did not write it out. You know, Justice, there's no excuse for my not doing that. I mean, there's no matter what I say, it's, as I said before, there's no excuse.
Right.
My fault and nobody else's fault but mine. But I discussed the matter many times with Mr. Peterson, and it never appeared to be a problem because he knew how hard I was working. I would also like to inform the court that during the course of my representation, when these matters were discussed with Mr. Peterson, unbeknownst to me, he was taping the conversation. I asked him if he was taping my conversations because it came clear to me he was taping a lot of other people's conversations, and I told him he better be careful because he might be violating the law, and indeed I believe he was. And then I asked him whether or not he was taping me. He indicated he was not, And I told him he best not, because if he did, and I found out about it, we would have very serious problems between us. So he knew justice, in spite of the fact that there was no written memorabilia of our agreement. He knew exactly every aspect of this case from top to bottom.
Now, was there an allegation here that you put his fees, his compensation, into your regular account rather than into your trust account?
Yes, ma'am. I do that in virtually every case where I am representing someone, where there's immediate action. In this case, the first 2 months of my representation of Mr. Peterson was primarily filled with working on his behalf. I did not put it in a trust account. I rarely do that because in my business, Your Honor, being primarily a criminal lawyer, we're not required to do it. And if we were to do it, we would have serious problems in trying to regulate our practice, because most of the people we represent are sitting in the county jail, and they think that we have to go up there and ask them to approve our use of monies that are in a trust account would be a very heavy burden. And actually, frankly, Your Honor, I think I'd choose to quit practicing law if I had to do that. I don't think I could operate my practice.
One of the counts was that you failed to keep him informed.
What was that last word?
Failed to keep him informed. That was count three.
Keep Mr. Peterson informed?
Yep. That's what it says.
Well, it's absolutely no merit to that. I've kept him informed of every aspect of it. I traveled to Florida when I hired and paid $10,000 to a lawyer down there to stop Mr. Gladstone from getting rid of some assets, because we thought that perhaps Mr. Peterson might be successful in retrieving some of those assets. I was down in Florida. I went to court with him West Palm Beach. Mr. Peterson, court will just have to accept what I say as my belief in the truth of it. I have never been more conversant with a client than I had been with Mr. Peterson. The problem occurred, unfortunately, through no fault of mine and no fault of Mr. Peterson's, Judge Gorenz of the federal bench, who had jurisdiction over this case, for whatever reason, took many, many months to decide the question as to insurance liability. I mean, like 10 or 12 months. And basically, during that time, we were handcuffed. We couldn't do anything, because that decision had to be made before we could go forward on anything else. And I don't know if it was work, she was overworked, or she was not well, but we didn't get a decision. And, of course, Mr. Peterson was always quite upset about that. But it wasn't his fault. It wasn't my fault. It's just a fact of life.
All right. What about the other claim by a victim?
Well, that's Mr. Gingrich is his name. He was the second largest dope dealer in the history of Waukesha County. I represented him. I received a $19,000 fee. That was the total fee. It was reported to the IRS that I had received that much in cash. The police department found $550,000 in monies in a locker belonging to Mr. Gingrich. They also found a number of chattels, such as cars, many cars, vintage cars, and it appears as though the letter that went out to him did not contain two phrases, one about arbitration, that he could ask for arbitration. Frankly, can't remember the other one. In retrospect, it was a mistake. I take responsibility for it. It was corrected. But also, I firmly believe it's a little silly, because if there was arbitration and any money was returned, it would go right to the police department or to the IRS.
So it's your position that although you did violate some of the code provisions, there should be no discipline?
Oh, I don't know. You can discipline me. I'll take it. But I just don't think I should be suspended.
Okay, so you want if we're going to discipline you, you want public reprimand or private reprimand?
Whatever the court feels appropriate under circumstances. The problem with obviously being suspended for any period of time is the few clients that I have left in the twilight of my career will be very harmed, very harmed, and I would like to continue to practice without interruption. And basically, my belief is that the penalty that's being suggested is because of those two cases, those DPA cases, that I didn't bring. I wouldn't bring them today, knowing all that I know at this very moment. To keep me from even having to have the embarrassment of having to report before this honorable court, I would not have filed those lawsuits. I thought a lawyer, when he takes charge of a case, is entitled to make decisions about that case, how the case is going to be run. He keeps in communication with his client, all of which I did. I told Mr. Peterson exactly what I was going to do. He was in complete agreement. It was a perfect plan. Because during the discovery, the gentleman from Hawaii was going to have to either admit that that was a false providence and that would be the end of the case, or he was going to have to take the fifth. There was a gentleman, an FBI agent by the name of Gray, who I met in New York City. I was there for another reason, but I met him in New York City, and he spoke highly of the purveyor that I was looking at. But I could tell, based upon my experience, he wasn't giving me a lot of information, which led me to believe there was a grand jury going on. And also, he asked us not to file a lawsuit at that time against the New York purveyor or anyone else for a while. And I know that he was trying to put together a case, and I honored that, and I talked to him thereafter. But it wouldn't have mattered because I was not planning on suing either of those two entities at that time. What I was hoping to get was either a Fifth Amendment statement by the guy in Hawaii, which I think would have given the impetus to the FBI to formally start a grand jury. Mr. Peterson's avowed purpose when he hired me was to destroy the memorabilia business, so that other people would not be hurt like he was.
Counselor, just to interrupt you a bit, did the sellers in New York and Florida repay your client's money for the purchase price and take the drawings back? How did that get resolved?
Sure. Here's what I know. After the case was going along, the gentleman in Florida was trying to move some property away from its being taken by others. I don't know whether it was Mr. Peterson or others, and I hired and paid for $10,000 to an attorney by the name of Michael Dotto, and I asked him to help me help Mr. Peterson down in Florida by finding a way to block that lawsuit or that kind of a bankruptcy proceeding so that they would not be able to destroy assets. He handled that to the best. And I understand as a result of that, at the end of the day, some payment was made. I was out of the case by that time. I had been discharged by Mr. Peterson, but I understand that there was a payment made. And to the case in New York, which although I didn't do anything other than advise Mr. Peterson, that ended up where Mr. Peterson was paid the amount of money that he was asking for in return for the items being sent back. That was done not through us. The one thing that they raised is that they didn't get attorney's fees. I would have had to start a lawsuit to get those attorney's fees, and I was not going to do it.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Boyle, you've had three prior private reprimands.
Correct.
2002, 2009, and 2012.
Yes, ma'am.
Right? I thought the reason you got the a referee's recommendation, which doesn't bind the court, you know that, for 60 days is because this is the fourth time you've come into contact with the OLR.
Yes, ma'am. And for the 40 years before that, I never had any. But the long and the short of it is, as I said, I never make excuses for errors made by anybody that worked for me. I accepted responsibility, and the court reads what those cases were about. The actions committed were not committed by me, but I accepted the responsibility because it was my firm.
How many people are in your firm now, Mr. Boyle?
Now me, just me, Judge. I'm on the waning days. There were three lawyers.
Uh-huh.
There were three lawyers, two, one investigator, a paralegal, and a secretary. Now there's just myself and a paralegal. I mean, the time has come.
How long do you estimate it would take you to finish up the cases you now have in the office?
6-8 months. One's a murder case that's been set to next April or May out of Portage County, and I really feel a duty and obligation to assist that man. The rest of them are not long. By that means, a few months. It's not that I want to quit, Your Honor. It's, you know, I see some of my buddies who quit got a little Alzheimer's coming, so I'm trying to keep from having that happen.
Counsel, I heard you say that you don't think criminal defense lawyers are required to follow the trust account rules.
No, I didn't say that. I just say there is an option by which we don't have to comply with it.
Can you walk the court through that option for us? Because count six is pretty much all about a violation of trust account rules in a criminal matter.
With all due respect, and I know I'm going to annoy the court by saying that in the 45 years before any of this happened, I never had one problem with the way I operate the financial part of my practice. It's when the new rule came in that when I first heard of it, I decided that I was going to have to quit practicing law because practically I could not have practiced law with the standards that were demanded by the SCRs. I just would not have been able to do it. I had 7 employees, and I had to pay them, and I had to get the wherewithal to do so. And when money came in, since it was a criminal matter, I tried to take advantage of what I thought was my options, and that is that I could put that money in my operating account and take care of my responsibilities. And I think that still is there. And I just really think that this, for criminal lawyers, this business about using clients' trust accounts would be very difficult.
Were these funds that you got from DP, were you entitled to these funds regardless of the time you spent on the case and regardless of the results?
Yes, ma'am. And well, certainly results is not to be considered, cannot be considered. And there can't be any change in the relationship because it's not what we anticipated and it was more difficult than it was. You're stuck with the agreement, and sometimes you make out, and sometimes you lose a lot. And usually I think the clients are very happy that they know what their fee is going to be, and they don't have to worry about any more monies having to be found. And many of them are sitting in jail, not getting out to do anything. And they have to go to family. So basically I think the rule and giving the criminal defense lawyer the opportunity of representing people in the manner and form which is acceptable is really better for the defendant.
Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. Keep these on.
Honorable Justices, My name is Robert Crone. I'm retained counsel for the Office of Lawyer Regulation.
Excuse me, Counselor. Before you begin, would you raise the podium? I think it will help us hear you better.
I can. I guess 6'6" attorneys are not the standard here.
No. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. In this case, Referee Dugan issued a 38-page report. I urge you to read that very carefully.
Can criminal defense lawyers charge a flat fee for a case?
Now?
Yes.
I think there are some circumstances under the rules that they can do that, but in terms of when this was occurring and the way it was done in Mr. Boyle's case, it was not appropriate under that rule.
Would he be subject to charges now under the rule as it exists?
I'd have to review that. I don't know.
Okay, fair enough.
No.
Were you at all a part of the hearing that we previously had with regard to trust accounts where the criminal defense bar showed up in large numbers saying it was unworkable for them?
No, I wasn't. Five counts here. The referee found that they were all proven. All the facts were not clearly erroneous. Credibility issues, all of them were resolved on behalf of the OLR against Mr. Boyle.
Five or six counts.
Mr. Boyle.
Five or six counts. I'm sorry.
Five counts involving DP and one other count regarding Mr. Gringis. I'm sorry. Mr. Boyle presents here as affable, contrite, no excuses, humble. Read the referee's report. She characterizes behavior at the hearing as dismissive towards the OLR, unnecessary deprecatory remarks towards me and towards the OLR, argumentative, contradictory testimony, and these are quotes, and he, in not one instance did he refute the counts of the OLR, the proof.
So is he getting the recommendations that are being made here today because of his behavior at the hearing?
No.
More than the underlying offenses?
No, but I think the behavior at the hearing gives you some sense of what he thinks of these rules and how he intends to use those rules in his office. Mr. Peterson, Mr. DP in this case, was very proactive in terms of the John Lennon memorabilia. He laid the information on the desk of Mr. Boyle. He had the provenance. He had talked with Mr. Spikin about the ink. He is an encyclopedia about this issue, about the Beatles and about the issue. He was virtually the ideal client in terms of information. The counts in this case, unearned fees and trust, not putting them in trust, on three occasions, has been admitted, count one. Count two, failure to communicate the scope of the representation, no fee agreements. The fees are paid on three separate occasions, no fee agreements at any time. And the problem is that the knowledge of the client and the knowledge of Mr. Boyle never met in this case. The strategies that Mr. Boyle talks about now were never conveyed to Mr. Peterson. They were not clear, and that's precisely why you need a fee agreement that sets forth the scope and the nature of the representation and what you're going to do. Certainly, Mr. Peterson took this to Mr. Boyle with the idea that he's going to recover the money that he invested in this memorabilia, three different galleries, about $65,000. The third count is failure to respond to requests for information. Mr. Boyle, in the case of the Hawaii case, tells his client to get evidence to establish jurisdiction. Mr. DP, I should tell you, did most of the legal work in this case, as well as the factual digging. DP needed subpoenas, and he asked Mr. Boyle to prepare the subpoenas. He sent three emails in July of 2010. Mr. Boyle had asked him to get the information. Boyle never responded to the emails. Ultimately, he assigned the matter to his daughter, Bridget Boyle, who in August, a year later, prepared an unsigned form subpoena to try to convince the client that he were doing something. And never was anything done in terms of those subpoenas. Now Boyle says, well, they weren't needed, or we just didn't need them. But those strategies and information were never conveyed to Peterson. Yes, there were a lot of conversations between attorney and client, but all it was telephone bluster, promises. I'm going to do this. Oh, sure, I'll do that. Oh, yeah, we'll do this. You help me with this. 3 years of this, nothing really transpires. He's fired a couple of times, then rehired because more promises are made. So first three counts were clearly established, as was the fourth count, reasonable diligence. Failure to file timely lawsuits under the Trade Act in the Hawaii law, as to the Hawaii Gallery and the New York Gallery. And as a result, the statute of limitations had run as to causes of action under the Federal Trade Practices Act.
Okay. He says he couldn't file them here because he couldn't get jurisdiction. Could he have filed them in New York or in Florida?
Well, his conclusion, well, first of all, he did file the claim in against the Hawaii Gallery. He filed it in Milwaukee, in the federal court in Milwaukee. And that's the case where he asked the client to get jurisdictional information after filing the lawsuit, thinking that jurisdiction was going to be challenged. Could he have filed it against the New York Gallery? Certainly.
Where?
Well, he could have filed in Wisconsin, the federal court in Wisconsin. There was sufficient communications back and forth. And if Mr. Boyle now says he couldn't have done that, that conclusion was never conveyed to the client, the reasons for it, nor is there any work product or information, research showing that he couldn't have done that. And in fact, he did, on occasions, promise that he was going to file a lawsuit. In these various conversations with DP, he, in one of them, in an email, he says, "We, quote, got New York," end of quote. And then he's terminated and rehired, and he says, "We will file against New York." And then in August of 2010, DP writes an email to Mr. Boyle, says his delay in filing against New York is just totally unacceptable. When are you going to do it? So there's this chain of emails, chain of calls, and promises after promises. Nowhere is he saying, "Oh, we can't establish jurisdiction for these reasons." He says, "No, we're going to do it." But he never does it. Never does it. 3 years. Failure to act. Failure to act with appropriate diligence on behalf of a client. He's paid him close to $70,000.
Counselor, he points out in his argument to us and elsewhere that the lawsuit was delayed because there was a long time in a decision by the federal judge on insurance coverage. Can you speak to that, please?
Yes. The lawsuit wasn't delayed because of it. Well, the filing of the lawsuit was not delayed because the jurisdictional issue or the insurance issue came up after the case was filed. So there was this great delay in filing the Hawaiian lawsuit. He did not include the trade practices causes of action. And then after that, the court had it, and I'm not sure about the time, but there was a delay as the insurance companies were challenging whether there was coverage. And there was a delay there, but that didn't prevent a more timely, earlier filing of the lawsuit. And that had nothing to do with his inaction against New York. The New York Gallery. In fact, in those lawsuit, the outcome, the Hawaiian case that he did commence, was ultimately settled by Mr. Peterson through the use of another attorney.
The New York matter
was likewise settled by Mr. Peterson directly. Mr. Boyle had nothing to do with the resolution of those cases.
Counts 1 and 2 relate to the failure to have a fee agreement and the failure to have a trust account in a civil case. Count 6 relates to not having a trust account in a criminal case. Let's start with 6. Do you agree or disagree that a criminal lawyer has to have a trust account in a criminal case?
Yeah, I agree that a trust account is a requirement.
Now? Or?
I believe so.
Okay. So you still think that's a viable charge? Okay. Counts 1 and 2 relate to the fee. And what I hear you say is this client would have been well informed had Attorney Boyle complied with the requirement to have a fee agreement and to deposit these funds in a trust account.
Well, it certainly would have helped to have a fee agreement that somehow or another laid out what the fee was for and what he was going to do.
Okay. Would a fee agreement typically say something like, "I will file a Deceptive Trade Practices Act lawsuit"? Or does it, is it looser than that so that there's room to figure out what can be filed?
I think it's more general. I think you could say here are the remedies. You can negotiate a settlement. If necessary, we can file a lawsuit. You can't anticipate every particular thing you're going to do or not to do, but that's not an excuse for not having any agreement or not saying anything in writing. Now, as far as the
failure
to provide...
Let me just ask you this. As Justice Bradley pointed out, there was a hue and a cry about the trust account and what you do with fees in two areas especially. One was criminal and the other was family, if I remember that correctly. And the rules changed over a period of time. And I'm not sure that the rules are still satisfactory to many lawyers. But you prosecuted this case under rules in effect at that time.
That's
even
correct.
Even though they were changed, right?
That's correct. And I understand there have been changes.
Yeah. So seems as if your position is that just because you don't like the rule, just because you don't believe in it, just because it makes it hard to practice law, you're held to it anyway until it's changed.
Yes, I understand that. And those are some mitigating circumstances, how that rule has evolved and changed. But I'll tell you, members of the court, those particular violations are really not the most important ones here. What we're really concerned about is the diligence. What we're really concerned about is the failure to provide competent representation, allowing the statute of limitations to run on the against two of the galleries, and the fact that he did not engage in any negotiations, no discovery. And all there were conversations on the phone and promises, no explanations to the client. And
what was the subpoena supposed to be for?
The subpoena was supposed to be for obtaining information to establish jurisdictional contacts.
I thought it was telephone
Hawaii
records.
Between Hawaii and Wisconsin.
Long-distance telephone records.
And he asked, I'm not sure I heard you, but he asked DP, said, "This is we're going to need information to establish a jurisdictional contact." DP tried to get it from the phone company, to establish phone contacts. The phone company said, "We're going to need a subpoena." DP went back to Mr. Boyle and said, "We're going to need a subpoena."
That's what I'm looking to clarify. You put your finger on. Was DP supposed to get his own long-distance phone records? That's how I read it, that Attorney Boyle said, "Look, we don't need to get it from them because you have these records, and you can get your own phone records, so go ahead and do that and get them for 2007 through whatever the years were after that." And then DP came back and said, "No, I need a subpoena to get."
That was based upon information provided to him by the telephone company. Now, as to which records he was looking for, I assume they were perhaps Mr. Boyle's records, perhaps his own records. I'm not sure. But in any event, the phone company said you need a subpoena.
To get your own phone records, you need a
whatever
subpoena.
Whatever records he was looking for. If it was looking for Mr. Boyle's records, he would have needed a subpoena. And I think he was. He says this is his own records. And that was a requirement told to him. So the competency count, number five, allowing the statute to run, we had an expert, expert Connolly, testified, not really challenged seriously, who said that there was not adequate preparation, the methods and procedures used by Mr. Boyle were not adequate, there were no negotiations, no discovery, and he never really even settled the case. He did file it, and that was the extent of it. And the damages in that case were not only what he had paid for the memorabilia, but also potential attorney's fees could be obtained under the Trade Practices Act. And when you let the statute run as to that act, you lose out on those particular remedies. And that was the failure to provide competent representation.
Counsel, one of the counts has been discussed a bit. That is count six, in response in part to Justice Ziegler's questions. I want to focus on count six a bit more. Count six indicates a violation of the trust account, as the facts set forth in the complaint assert, and as at the hearing presented, that there was $9,500 that was received on November 3rd, 2011, that Attorney Boyle deposited into the firm's operating account. Another $9,500 was deposited on November 25th of that year, and 4 days later there was a written fee agreement indicating that the initial retainer fee was non-refundable, and the client signed the fee agreement on December 2nd. Count six, you are asking that we impose discipline for that count. What should he have done is your, what are you asserting he should have done with what he considers the initial retainer of the $9,500? Play that out for me. Are you asserting that it is hourly?
It is what?
Hourly. An hourly fee. And even though it was a initial retainer fee, that he could only take it out on an hourly basis? What are you asserting? What should have he done, or what should he have done, rather, in order to comply with the rule as you see it? He's not charged with a written fee agreement violation in this one because he had one, albeit a little late.
That's the problem, that there's no fee agreement that sets out what he's to do and how he's to charge for those things. In the absence of that agreement, has him putting his money in his operating account, and then later on trying to figure out, well, how are we going to do this now?
Well, he's not charged in this particular case with a lack of a fee agreement. He's charged with a trust account violation. So
that's right.
What should he have done? What's your position how this should have unfolded with the initial retainer of $9,500 and the subsequently signed fee agreement?
Well, in the absence of a fee agreement, he should have at least conversed or laid out how he was going to charge Mr. Grinkus from the get-go or as he's getting into the case.
Okay, that sounds like fee agreement orally. When did he earn this $9,500 retainer?
Well, customarily in the criminal law, as I understand it, charges are typically made on an hourly basis. Sometimes there are flat fees, sometimes they're not. But in the absence of any understanding, he, I suppose, could have said, well, my flat fee is $19,000 for what I've done after the fact. And if he has time records, he could support it with his time records, or he could support it with his agreement that set a flat fee.
Are you asserting, then, because of a lack of hourly time records that he couldn't charge that retainer? He didn't earn that retainer?
No, I'm not saying that. No, I'm not saying that. It kind of depends on what is a reasonable fee under the rules. There's a test for what a reasonable fee is. What is the work done? What is the experience of the attorney? What is the result? You look at all these factors, and he would fashion a fee. And then maybe the fee would be more, maybe it would be less. But here, there's just a statement that's unrefundable, and later on, it's nothing happens. The fee is kept; it's in the operating account; it's gone, and that's the problem. So, I know this fee issue in terms of criminal practice is very difficult, and I know these rules have changed from time to time, and that makes it even more difficult. And I'm not representing myself as a historian on the history of those rules. I'm given the case that. To plead based on the violations at the point in time. And that's what I've done. So I understand your dilemma.
And count,
in terms of sanctions,
count six relates to RG. The other counts relate to DP. All right.
Yes, the five counts DP. In terms of sanction, here's the rub here in terms of sanction. You follow a progressive disciplinary practice here in the court, 60-day suspension, we feel, is a minimum most appropriate sanction. We've got prior discipline of the same kinds of things. Back in 2002, not acting diligently, just like now. Back in 2012, just 3 years ago, no written fee agreement, failure to explain a fee. Another violation in 2009. So the message is clearly not getting through to Mr. Boyle, and as you hear him talk about how he runs his office and his fee arrangements for criminal cases, it's clear that the message isn't getting through. There's a disconnect here. But the rules are the rules, and he's violated them. The ABA standards talk about suspension for repeaters, fee rule violations, the question of not competent representation, the question of lack of diligence that runs through all of these cases, the methods, the preparation, the thoroughness of the work that he done is totally lacking, as the referee found. And the case law, which was very closely analyzed by the referee, I think is helpful. The Anderson case and the Theobald case involve diligence, failure to inform a client, three counts, some prior discipline, and both involve 60-day suspensions. There was harm here. I don't want you to think that DP just walked away without being harmed. Not only was his initial investment gone, but he had years of delay and frustration. He is a very hands-on client. He wants to know everything. He's very demanding, and he's very knowledgeable about the Beatles and the records in this case. And Mr. Boyle knew that going in, and they had a good relationship to start with. But over time, it turned into this quagmire of promises and calls and nothing going on, nothing doing. And he just had to get other attorneys to complete these cases, which he did. And so it was exceedingly frustrating for a man of this type who had such an attraction to the issues and was so interested in justice here. We have here a repeater in terms of a violator. Repeater involving the same violations. Never really offered, according to the referee Dugan in her 30-plus page report, said he really never offered a legitimate defense to any of this, no serious defense to any of the counts.
I think he disputes the facts, Counselor, at least before us. He says there was a lot of communication. He did talk with him often on a regular basis. The client, as you say, was very involved. He agrees with you. The client was very involved with him in these lawsuits. So at least before us, he's saying the facts are really not that he didn't communicate, not that he didn't keep the client.
Was there communication? Yes, there was talking on the phone back and forth. Was there meaningful communication to progress the case to some kind of resolution? No. Was there action? No. There was promises, communication of promises.
Well, that would be a lack of diligence, really, not
that's,
a lack
that's
of
the
communication.
Count. Yeah, it's not it's more of the count four is lack of a diligence.
To do the work. Thank you.
Well, what was Attorney Boyle's position before the referee? Was it that he communicated a great deal in a meaningful way? And what did the referee state? What did the referee find about the communication?
The referee found that there were a lot of communications back and forth, nothing particularly meaningful in terms of advancing the case, and that there was a total lack of diligence. She found unfavorable on all the counts, and strongly so in terms of her decision. She was very adamant and thorough in terms of her analysis of the rules and the credibility questions which came up during the hearing. And trust me, when Mr. Boyle here says, well, I don't really want to contest that, I admit that. That wasn't the case at the hearing. There was a tooth and nail argument over almost every issue, even some that were ultimately stipulated to. So the referee ultimately expressed great apprehension about Mr. Boyle's understanding of the rules and his attitude towards the disciplinary process. That's an ominous communication and comment from a referee who doesn't normally make those kinds of comments in a report. And for that reason, she felt the 60-day suspension was appropriate. OLR feels it's appropriate, as does the director of OLR. And given all of the history and what went on in this case, lack of diligence, the fee issue, the lack of retainer agreement, the competency question, the six counts, all of which were established. Thank you.
Was 60 days what OLR requested from the beginning?
Yes, it was. I see an orange light. I have nothing further to say. I assume I can sit down in an orange light if I have nothing further to say.
Thank you. Attorney Boyle?
For counsel to basically start out with the fact that I was a feisty person before the referee is shocking, because I always thought, and I would think, that I could parade judges in here from all over the state that says I am nothing like that. But doesn't matter. OLR runs the show, and the referee can say what she wants. I have a right to defend myself as I would anybody else. And I say with all the humility that I can muster that I wouldn't have done one thing different if the respondent was somebody other than me. I had a right not to abide by their claim that I did things wrong, and I fought those. He said tooth and nail. I didn't think it was tooth and nail, but nonetheless, I took issue with it, and that's my right. And I thought I did it with the type of acumen that a lawyer develops after years of practice. To talk about advancing the case, what case was I advancing? Two cases didn't exist, would not exist, and I never would have brought them because they would have been thrown out. It would have been impossible to start a lawsuit in Florida only to find out that Wisconsin wouldn't take it, and then New York, whether or not they would take it. And I didn't have the proof. And Mr. Spikin, who's the one that told Peterson to hire me because I had done well on another case involving inking, we met. He came up from Florida, and we met in my office with Mr. Peterson for about 2 hours. We went through every aspect of it, and Mr. Spikin was in complete agreement. And I'm not just going to file a lawsuit so I don't have to answer to OLR later. I'm only file a lawsuit if I feel I got the proof, and I didn't have the proof.
Does the statute of limitations that ran require a misrepresentation? Is that why you were trying to get that particular fact? Because at that point in time, it seems to me there was a lot of evidence that these drawings were not as had as he thought they were when he bought them.
Thank you for the question. Mr. Spikin said to me, Jerry, how are you going to get over the problem that the person that signed it to Peterson had no more knowledge of it's not authentic than Peterson had, and that when he bought it from whomever, that he thought it was authentic, and then he sold it to Peterson, he thought it was authentic. Without a provenance, like we had in the Hawaii case, where we had absolute fraud on the face, I wasn't going to bring it. And I thought, as a lawyer, that's my right, and not to be second-guessed. If he wants to go and sue me in court, he can, but to go to OLR and say I let the statute lapse is absolutely absurdity.
Counsel, the referee indicated that there was substantial proof or sufficient proof to meet the charge of not being competent in this representation. The referee says the following: Attorney Boyle does not meet the standard of competent practitioners with respect to adequate preparation and use of methods and procedures. That DP sounded the statute of limitation warnings to the attorney. The record does not reflect that Attorney Boyle prepared the complaints, used methods and procedures available to him to prepare the complaints timely, etc.
She's wrong.
Your burden is to show that these findings are clearly erroneous.
They are.
So give us your best argument on why, not that she's wrong or that you disagree, why they are clearly erroneous.
erroneous because, as I understand the rule on DPA, I have to show a nexus between the seller and the state of Wisconsin. None of these people ever set a foot in the state of Wisconsin. None of these people advertised in anything within the state of Wisconsin. They advertised in magazines. They're all over the place. But none of them did any work. We could not find any prior clients, other clients that were buying from these people. We had nothing other than the instance of Mr. Peterson finding something in a magazine, getting hold of the purveyor of the magazine, and buying the item. I did not think, nor did Mr. Lowe, who wrote a very extensive memo that was given to Mr. Peterson that we discussed at length, telling us why we should not go the DPA, while at the same time he broke down every aspect of the Hawaii case, and I used that as my model to go forward. So what I don't understand, I don't know that the referee, with all due respect, understood what the case was all about. This was a case that I firmly believe that Mr. Peterson would have ended up not only being the recipient of a great deal of money, plus having punitive damages, because it was a clear fraud, in my opinion, and having the gentleman in Hawaii having a prior fraud with Mr. Peterson, and Mr. Peterson being squeaky clean as far as what he did with this purveyor. The purveyor had all kinds of blotches. The woman that worked in his shop was my witness. She was going to come forward and really lay it out against this guy. That's the case I wanted. And then I could go from there to Hawaii, ask him the questions. Did he know Jerry Gladstone? Did he know Mr. Kaczynski? Did he ever do any business with him? Where did he get the items from? Who gave them to him? What provenance? It would have been an incredibly wonderful deposition take of that gentleman. And as a result of that, I go to the FBI with it. And they were looking for something. Believe me, there's an FBI agent in Hawaii that was on top of it. There was an FBI agent in New York that was really on top of it. And they weren't taking any action against him because they didn't have what they needed. And I was going to get it for him. And once I got that, that goes to a grand jury. The gentleman in Hawaii is toast. And they will get the information out of him whether or not it was a conspiracy. And that's what Mr. Peterson wanted. He wanted $1 million. He wanted to destroy the memorabilia business. And he wanted to take the hide off of everybody that he ever dealt with. I did everything that anybody could ever ask a lawyer to do. And, I'm not talking about a lawyer that's been in the business 6 months. I've 54 years.
Thank you, counsel.
Pardon?
Thank you.
Thank you. Enjoyed it. Well, I didn't enjoy it, but thank you.
Thank you both for a very spirited argument and very interesting topics today. We are going to take a recess so that some students can come in and get situated before we do our next oral argument. So for the moment, we are adjourned. Thank you.